Chen Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Voices whisper, ancient secrets, signs and symbols are abundant. UFOs, ETs, ghosts, and even the dead move about freely. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Today's podcast will be different from what we usually do. We won't be interviewing anyone. Instead, we're going to delve into the mysterious world of time travel. We'll begin by describing a couple of experiences that Trish and I have had ourselves. Experiences that could be dismissed as misidentification of what really happened, but keep your mind open and wait until you hear the main story on this podcast. It's an incredible time travel, past life encounter, involving two Americans who met on the island of Bermuda. We'll also touch on the current scientific perspective on time travel to the past. And before getting into the details of that main story, I'll describe a well-known case of time travel to the past that took place in 1903 at the Versailles Palace, and that will lead into the longer story. Let's get started. This material is from part one of an unpublished book called Breach of Time. People like us, who believe in physics, know that the distinction between the past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion. Albert Einstein.
In the early 1980s, not too long after we had met, Rob and I were walking along the shore of a small lake in central Florida, near the village of Casadega, looking for a possible camping site. That's when it happened. The quiet afternoon erupted with voices, shouts, whoops, and barks, the chaotic sounds of a gathering, and they were just ahead around a grove of trees. We stopped, disappointed and somewhat confused. The place where we were headed was already occupied. We couldn't see anyone from where we stood, but it sounded like a large party near what we had thought would be an isolated location. The entire incident was auditory, and we both experienced it. But what was it? Did the location of the event, near Casadega, a spiritualist camp, come into play? Most of the residents are mediums and portend to communicate with spirits, but would the spirits gather for a party and whoop it up in that field? It didn't feel right to me. In fact, in the immediate aftermath of the incident, it occurred to me that maybe we tuned into the past and heard voices and sounds from a Native American village. Later, we found out that four tribes, the Timucua, Tocobaga, Jororo, and Mayaca, all had villages in central Florida.
Of course, the idea that Trish and I had walked back in time and heard voices from the past is speculation. But it prompted us to see if we could intentionally walk into the past. To that end, one Sunday afternoon, several weeks later, we meditated on the idea that we could enter a deeply relaxed state and would be able to walk into the past. At that time, we had just met, and I lived in an apartment across the street from a large park. Our goal would be to look for something in the park, something different, that indicated we had walked temporarily into another time. To prepare, we took a couple of walks in the park and tried to remember everything we saw. But how much would a park change over time? Of course, that would depend on what time frame we entered. We didn't select a date or even a year. We decided to leave it open and just focus on walking into the past and finding evidence that we were successful. We meditated on a park bench so that we were already in the park and wouldn't be distracted by anything outside of the park. Looking back now, we were no doubt somewhat gullible to believe that we could meditate our way into the past. But we were at the beginning of a journey. After entering a deeply relaxed state and programming our intention over and over, we stood up, eyes half closed, and began walking. No doubt if anyone saw us, They might think we looked like a pair of somnambulists, but in our 20 minutes, we never crossed paths with anyone. That, in itself, was interesting, because it was a Sunday and a nice day. The lack of people oddly coincides with the scenario in the time travel story that is at the heart of part one of this book. We remained silent during the walk so we could remain in the meditative state. Finally, we returned to the apartment and talked about what we saw. Neither of us found that the park looked any different than our earlier walks. We were disappointed, but we had intentionally selected the park as a target because it would be easier to believe that we had walked into the past without being distracted by objects such as cars that would tell us that we were still in the present. It seemed that we had failed, and we talked about whether it was worthwhile to try again. But then something came to mind that suggested that maybe we did move, had moved through time. It wasn't something that appeared different in the park. It was something missing. Neither of us remembered seeing a small wooden bridge that crossed over a gully where runoff from rain flowed after storms. Had we just overlooked it? Maybe. But it gave us a what-if moment. What if we had actually moved back in time to a point before that bridge was built? We walked over to the bridge, which spanned about 10 feet by 3 feet, and wondered how neither of us had noticed it. We don't know if time travel was involved in either experience, but we both became interested in the possibility. Writing as T.J. McGregor, Trish went on to write 3 time travel novels, Black Water, Kill Time, and Running Time. I also tackled time travel in Romancing the Raven and Time Catcher. We never lost my interest in the possibility that time travel might exist outside of science fiction, and years later, I co-authored The Fog, a book about the Bermuda Triangle, which focuses on a time jump incident experienced by my co-author, Bruce Jernan. Years after that book was published in 2005, I was contacted by John Murphy, a retired IT executive and former Coast Guardsman, who told him an extraordinary event that happened to him and a young woman in 1964, an event that can be described not only as time travel, but as a story of a lost love. This podcast will showcase John's story, which was corroborated by Barbara Jean, the woman who experienced it with him.
Introduction. Most people have never heard of the Hurricane Calixto, which is considered the deadliest Atlantic hurricane on record, with an estimated death toll of 22,000. Also known as the Great Hurricane, it swept through the Lesser Antilles on October 18, 1780, then struck Bermuda and caused devastating damage and death. Some 50 ships were driven ashore by the storm surge in Bermuda. Many homes were demolished in St. George, and the hamlet of St. Catherine was totally vanquished, killing most of the residents. One of the few survivors was an unborn infant boy who was cut from his dead mother by a midwife the morning after the storm. 184 years later, a young Coast Guardsman from North Carolina and a Navy nurse in training from Wisconsin say they walked back in time into that village before the hurricane hit. Neither of them, at the time, knew anything about the village or the hurricane that destroyed it. I believe it's the most astonishing and convincing time travel event to the past ever recorded.
After I heard John's incredible stories, I attempted on 2 occasions to get documentary film producers to record his story. They had contacted me about their plans for Bermuda Triangle episodes for cable channels. One of them took an interest in John's story, then dropped it when John died April 1, 2019, at age 74. I tried to write this story as a novel based on a real story, but I couldn't do it. I've written dozens of original novels, adapted scripts, including Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, and I've also ghostwritten many of other novels. Yet this story did not want to be written as fiction, so we'll tell it the way it deserves to be told, as a true story. I have no reason to believe that the 2 people involved lied to me. In fact, the couple had not been in contact for decades, until John found Barbara through a lengthy internet search. She not only remembered meeting him, but also remembered the village they'd walked into. Until that telephone call from John, Barbara had been unaware that the village did not exist in 1964. Besides the fact that neither had any reason to make up the story, they were both very believable people. They had completed their military careers in good standing and went on to marriages, families, and professions. And yet, both remembered walking into the pass. John spent 8 years in the Coast Guard and at age 24 became one of the youngest chief petty officers. After his service, he moved into the burgeoning computer field as a programmer and a technical manager. He later worked for a major long-distance carrier and developed national and international standards for the telecommunications industry. He retired in 2002 and had 6 grown children and 5 grandchildren.
Barbara Jean, who resides in Minnesota and prefers not to use her last name, graduated in 1966 with a Bachelor of Science degree in nursing. After several years working as a nurse, she received a master's degree in nursing. She continued nursing and authored a book about infection control in nursing homes. In 1984, she went to law school and became a lawyer in 1988. For the next 9 years, she primarily defended doctors and hospitals in malpractice suits. In 1997, she became the owner, administrator, and primary caregiver in a venture caring for the disabled, a career that she called the most rewarding in her life. She has 1 adopted son from her first marriage and 2 stepsons from her current marriage. What's even more extraordinary about their story is that John researched the history of that village with the help of an aged retired sailor on Bermuda, the descendant of that unborn baby who survived the hurricane, even though her mother didn't. Through his help, John found an intriguing connection between him and Barbara and the old sailor's ancestors who died in St. Catherine in the hurricane. Their names were also John and Barbara, and we'll tell their story from the 18th century records of their lives. The two couples, it seems, had more in common than just their names. It's a time travel romance, and it seems a past life encounter.
But before getting into their story, it's worth noting that scientists maintain that it's not possible to travel to the past. After all, if time is linear, then the past only exists in memories. But science is fluid, always changing. After all, until the early 19th century, mainstream science did not accept the idea that rocks sometimes fell from the sky, despite centuries of anecdotal tales. The scientific community of the day dismissed the idea as superstition or considered such occurrences as an earthly matter, possibly the result of lightning striking rocks and exploding them into the air. Now, of course, the existence of meteorites is well established and is a field of study called meteoritics that is closely connected to cosmochemistry, mineralogy, and geochemistry. Time travel, especially to the past, remains in the same realm of disbelief as rocks falling from the sky once did. One of the arguments used against travel to the past is what's known as the grandfather paradox. Traveling back in time could allow someone to prevent their own birth by killing their ancestor, leading to a logical contradiction. Also, the second law of thermodynamics states entropy, disorder, in an isolated system always increases. Time travel to the past would necessitate reversing entropy, effectively undoing events, which contradicts the fundamental laws of physics. Both arguments are based on linear time. However, the possibilities for time travel to the past is greatly enhanced by theories of alternate dimensions, parallel universes, and multiverses. In 1957, physicist Hugh Everett III first introduced the many worlds interpretation to address certain puzzles in quantum mechanics. Everett's idea was both simple and radical. Every time a quantum measurement occurs, the universe splits into parallel universes, each representing a possible outcome. In other words, rather than having only one reality where events unfold in a singular way, the theory asserts that all possible outcomes happen simultaneously, each within its own separate branch of reality. Similarly, the multiverse theory suggests the existence of multiple, perhaps infinite, parallel universes, each universe potentially differing in physical laws, histories, and outcomes. While it's often associated with science fiction, the concept has significant theoretical grounding in cosmology, quantum physics, and philosophy. In the 1980s, Alan Guth proposed cosmic inflation, suggesting the universe rapidly expanded immediately after the Big Bang. André Linde expanded this theory into eternal inflation, proposing that inflation never fully ends, continuously spawning new universes that form a larger multiverse. Physicists Leonard Susskind and Brian Green have discussed how string theory, fundamental reality composed of tiny vibrating strings, may suggest a landscape of thousands of possible universes, each with distinct physical laws. What the multiverse hypothesis tells us is that it's best to think about travel to the past as a leap into another dimension, rather than backtracking along a linear timeline. In other words, alternate timelines would prevent paradoxes. If you killed your grandfather before you were born, that event would happen in a parallel dimension and would not create an impossibility. Even though our current scientific understanding tells us that time travel to the past is impossible, it cannot be categorically disproven.
Besides, there are witnesses, people who believe they walked back in time. Before we begin the astonishing story that the young American military couple, we'll cite a well-known time travel event from 1901 that involved two British women, both academics, who claimed they experienced a time slip while visiting the Petit Trianon on the grounds of the Palace of Versailles. They later wrote about it in a book called An Adventure. Charlotte Ann Moberly, who was the principal of St. Hugh's College in Oxford, needed someone to help run the college for women and hired Eleanor Jourdain as vice principal. Before Jourdain was hired, they decided to take a trip to Versailles Palace together so they could get to know each other better. Jourdain owned an apartment in Paris where she tutored English children, and Moberly stayed with her. They witnessed scenes and odd individuals dressed in late 18th century garb, including a man with a pockmarked face in a cloak and tricorn hat, and figures they believed to be Marie Antoinette and her entourage. Also, servants and gardeners in antique dress. They felt disoriented, as though they'd stepped out of time, into a landscape that seemed unnatural. They described feelings of oppression, strange and eerie sensations, and an atmosphere that was oppressive, possibly the era just before the French Revolution. Critics of the story say that it could have been a case of shared delusion or misinterpretation of ordinary events. Some believe the story was exaggerated or invented, perhaps subconsciously, as a result of their shared closeness and interest in spiritualism. Regardless, it's an enduring tale that has intrigued people interested in time travel or hauntings for well over a century. Without a doubt, the two educated women were convinced they had briefly walked into another time. What makes the featured story truly unique, and the reason that it's only story in part one, is that it not only involves time travel to the past experienced by two people, but it suggests a past-life link. If that's not enough, the story also is enfolded into the Bermuda Triangle saga. Since it took place in Bermuda and involved a horrific storm known as the Great Hurricane of 1780, or Hurricane Calixto. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Chapter 1. The Village. November 26, 1964. Thanksgiving Day. The day it happened began at midnight for John Murphy. The 311-foot Coast Guard cutter Half Moon was anchored at Penos Wharf in St. George, Bermuda, and Murphy, a third-class petty officer, took over the quarterdeck watch. The guardsmen were taking a break for the holiday from their daily search and rescue training at the beautiful but isolated mid-ocean isle. The tall, muscular 19-year-old and Billy, an even younger messenger assistant, were responsible for the safety and security of the $12 million ship, along with its complement of 135 officers and men. The four-hour mid-watch was quiet and uneventful, with most of the crew asleep below deck, anticipating the Thanksgiving dinner. One thing that John remembered from that watch, though, was a comment that Billy made to him that later would echo in his mind for its irony. You don't want to take any chances, do you? You want everything planned and orderly. That's why you got engaged and you're only 19. Take it from me, that's not how life always goes. Sometimes life throws you for a loop. At noon, the ship's commissary department began serving the guardsmen their Thanksgiving feast with turkey and ham, all the traditional trimmings, including pumpkin pie. After the sumptuous dinner, John and three other members of the crew went ashore to have a holiday drink at the nearby White Horse Tavern, and then began walking around to burn off some of the excessive calories from their dinner. As they walked by a small restaurant just off the town square, they looked through the window and saw four young women sitting at a table. They decided to go inside to see if they could join them. After some quick introductions, the men learned the women were student nurses in the Navy Nurse Corps. Luckily, each of the four men was attracted to a different nurse, and in a convenient coincidence, each girl seemed attracted to their corresponding would-be suitor. The nurse that appealed to John was easily the prettiest of the group, a slender blonde named Barbara Jean from a small town in Wisconsin. He noticed that her blue eyes twinkled every time she smiled. As he sat across from her at the table, he thought she was one of the prettiest young women he'd ever met. They all left the restaurant together and invited the girls to a tour of the ship. They were heading home the next day and happy to spend some time with new friends. After the tour, the couples went their separate ways. John and Barbara walked off toward Fort St. Catherine, a massive fortress built by Bermuda's first governor, Richard Moore, to defend the island against attacks from the Spanish. They settled on a stone wall near the fort and watched the sun sink lower against the sky. Imagine it, a couple of strangers attracted to each other, the romantic island and sunset, and the deserted place where they'd settled to talk. As they talked about their lives, both confided that they felt comfortable, as if they'd known each other for years. It was a visceral certainty, John thought. Yet they both were engaged to someone back home, and neither of them was looking to have an affair. They slid off the wall, and to extend their time together, they followed a narrow lane that led away from the fort rather than walking along the beach, the way they'd come. As we started walking up toward the crest of the rise, a vision of what was on the other side of the hill began to form in my mind's eye. I was able to picture a very old village with a small stone church standing prominently in the middle. The vision was so realistic that I stopped before we reached the top of the hill so I could tell Barbara what I was seeing. For a moment, I was worried she might think I was crazy or trying some kind of trick to seduce her. He looked toward her in the gathering darkness, and she appeared to be shaken, and said she was also having eerie feelings about the place. They started up the rest of the hill, but then after taking just a few steps, Barbara stopped, and her hands were shaking. She turned toward him and said she'd just remembered something about the clock in the church steeple. It stopped working a long time ago, frozen at 12:30.
They gripped each other's hands even tighter, both feeling tense and more than a little spooked. When we reached the crest of the hill, a village stretched out before us, just as I had seen in the vision. Barbara said just the single word, "Look," as she pointed in the direction of the steeple. The hands of the clock were on 12:30, just as she'd said. John felt a sense of familiarity, as if he knew this village from other visits, almost a sense as if he had once lived there. When he uttered those thoughts, Barbara simply nodded, a stunned look on her face. Unlike the colorful pastels of the homes they'd seen in modern-day St. George, the cottages were uniformly constructed of uncolored limestone. Although it didn't seem strange at first, each habitation had an oil lamp sitting on a table, clearly visible through windows that were hinged on one side so they could swing out for ventilation. Peering into these rustic cottages was like looking back into time. The only thing missing was the residents. No one was outside, and they didn't see anyone when they looked through the windows. Even though the setting was ethereal, it felt like a real place, not a hallucination. At the same time, it was peaceful, and neither of them felt afraid or threatened. When they walked by the church, John noticed a pair of oil-lit lamps on either side of the doorway, clearly showing the rough-hewn wood making up the panels of the closed door. I approached the door and grasped the handle. The door creaked as I attempted to open it, but it was locked. A solitary cottage some 50 paces beyond the chapel attracted their attention. They strolled over to it, hand in hand, and looked in the kitchen window, where a lamp illuminated the room. I imagined that Barbara Jean and I had once lived in this house. I turned to her and said, "This was our house." She smiled at me, and we moved on, walking around the perimeter of the limestone cottage. From there, they walked toward the graveyard adjacent to the church. They came to the low stone wall separating the graveyard in two parts and sat down on the broad, flat stones. They somehow knew the cemetery's segregated layout, whites on one side, blacks on the other. They were lost in reverie for a time, then shared their feelings of having lived together in this very same place at some time in the distant past. John suggested that maybe they had lived here together in another life. Barbara Jean played along, imagining they lived here as a married couple with children, and he added that they died together, somewhere nearby, and that there had been something unusual about the way they'd died. Barbara frowned and told him that she didn't like that part of the story. They both agreed that nothing about the evening seemed normal, from their meeting to the discovery of the village. Barbara had a blanket in her bag from when she and her friends had gone to the beach earlier in the day and spread it on the ground. Darkness had captured the village, providing them a sense of privacy. They stretched out, and John felt a nearly overwhelming love and passion as they embraced. He'd never kissed anyone in a graveyard before, but he felt an overwhelming desire to do so. I closed my eyes and leaned forward to kiss her, but before our lips came together, everything around us grew dark, and it felt as if we were tumbling together into a bottomless abyss. The sensation of falling finally ended, but, oddly enough, we both passed out. When they came awake, a couple of hours had passed. They were confused and quickly left the village after taking one more look at the illuminated cottages. John walked Barbara to the hotel in St. George where she and her friends were staying. Their goodbye was awkward, but they exchanged addresses and went their separate ways. She would fly back to the U.S. the next day, and he would remain in Bermuda for another 10 days.
Chapter 2. The Return. That night, John had a vivid dream about the village in which he saw shadowy figures moving about. He was looking for Barbara and knew she was there. When he woke up, he felt energized and knew he had to go back and find out more about its history so he might be able to figure out why he and Barbara were attracted to it. At this point, John was thinking about romance and past lives, that he'd met the woman of his dreams and they'd lived together in the village. After several days and nights offshore conducting drills and maneuvers, the Half Moon sailed in through Town Cut Channel on Sunday morning. Once they were tied up at the wharf, John climbed up on the deck over the top of the oceanography lab in search of solitude and peace. He wanted to think about what happened on Thanksgiving and relive the experience in his mind. Thinking of the beautiful blonde nursing student brought a pleasing vision of her countenance to mind, but it soon faded and gave way to feelings of terrible loneliness. "I wished she had been able to remain on the island until after we returned from our drills, so we could have bid each other a more meaningful goodbye. Even though we were hundreds of miles apart by this point in time, I felt an overwhelming need to somehow reconnect with her. The way I could do that now was to return to the village we had explored together. Thinking back to the way we had known what would appear over the hill on Thanksgiving night was both heartwarming, but also somewhat disturbing. I didn't think anything else could ever be that bizarre." He had to wait until noon for liberty to be granted, and then went ashore to set out for the old village. He didn't tell any of his friends where he was going or why. He just went off by himself, thinking about his time with Barbara and wondering if he would feel the same sense of eeriness and familiarity. He also wanted to recreate the sense of being with her and the uncanny feeling that they'd lived there as a married couple. He was going to sit on the graveyard wall and write a poem for her. He also wanted a better look at the village and see if he could talk to any residents about its history.
Upon reaching the top of the hill on the narrow roadway, he looked ahead and couldn't believe what he saw, or more precisely, what he didn't see. Off to the right, the only things visible was the ruins of a church, but not the same church, not the same location. Straight ahead, there weren't any houses or even foundations left of what had been an entire village a few nights before. No village, no church or steeple with a broken clock, just wide open pasture land. Decades later, he recalled his surprise. I fully expected the village to be there. I wanted to see it in daylight. I wanted to find a place to sit and write a letter to Barbara. I was totally surprised and shocked. I walked around in a daze, baffled and refusing to believe what my own eyes were seeing. More than once, I wondered if I was losing my mind. The only thing that convinced him of his sanity was the piece of paper in his pocket with Barbara's address and phone number written on it, together with a heart she had drawn next to her name. The two of us had seen the village together, and both had experienced the same confusing loss of consciousness, only to wake up still in the village. John doubted that they'd both gone mad, so he knew there had to be another explanation. He started back toward St. George and decided to stop for a drink when he came to the Gunpowder Cavern, a pub built inside a tunnel in a hillside on the outskirts of St. George. By then, I felt I could really use one. The bar was empty, except for an old bartender, a craggy-looking fellow who appeared to be in his late 60s or early 70s. Because of his age, I thought he might know something about what I had seen. I bought him a drink and asked what he knew of the place on the other side of the hill. He mentioned construction of a church in the 1870s that was never completed after a hurricane caused heavy damage. He seemed surprised that John had noticed it, since it wasn't on the tourist maps. It wasn't there on Thanksgiving, John thought, not when he and Barbara Jean had walked by. When he queried him further, the bartender said there had been an earlier settlement not far from the location of the unfinished church. He thought it had been built in the early 1700s, but wasn't sure of any other information about it. He thanked him for his help and started to walk out the door. Just as John reached the doorway, the bartender suggested that he visit an old sea captain in St. George named Sam. He said the captain's ancestors used to live in the lost village of St. Catherine, then made a sketch on a napkin showing John where the old captain lived. He thanked him for the map and said he would pay the captain a visit. At that point, the bartender suddenly remembered he'd heard through the island grapevine that Sam was away from Bermuda on an extended trip back to England and wouldn't be back until after the first of the year. John decided to make sure that bartender was right, so he followed the directions and found the house. A neighbor called out from her window that he would be gone until after Christmas. Disappointed, he walked back to the square and joined some of my friends in the White Horse Tavern. Two of his shipmates, who had been with Barbara's friends on Thanksgiving, were bragging and telling stories about how well they'd made out with their girls. Before anyone started to ask him about Barbara Jean, John finished his drink and went back to the ship. He was sure his friends would have laughed if he'd told them his story. They wouldn't believe it, but no doubt they would spread the story around the ship and he would be tagged with a nickname, Time Traveler. Even though it would be true, to the guardsmen on the Half Moon, it would be a joke. After he climbed the gangway to the deck, he looked back at St. George. He was sure that the ship would be returning to Bermuda sometime within the next 12 months, and when it did, he would find his way to Captain Sam's house and talk to him about the lost village.
I exchanged numerous emails with John in the years before his death in 2019. He wanted the world to know his story about a lost village, a lost love, and the incredible affinity he felt that he and Barbara had with that village. More on that later. He wanted me to know that the village was not a figment or a dreamscape, but was real and solid when he and Barbara walked into it. I don't know if it's important, but thought you might want to know that we were able to touch and feel the houses and the church, and both of us sat on the graveyard wall. These were solid objects, not projections or holographic images. Also, when we tried to enter the church, the doors wouldn't open, but they made noise when I pulled and pushed on the door handle, so there were definitely sounds. One unusual detail that John had provided on their walk into the village was the prediction of a clock on the church steeple that was broken and stuck at 12:30. In spite of the astonishing oddity that Barbara accurately predicted the clock, I found it difficult to believe that John would make up a clock on a church steeple and the story that went with it. I also couldn't help wondering how such an outdoor clock functioned in the 1700s before the advent of electricity, and I also wondered if it was common for clocks to be part of a church's steeples. I asked ChatGPT about those clocks, and of course the AI knew all about it. In the 18th century, outdoor clocks, like those on church towers, relied on a combination of mechanical and astronomical principles for timekeeping. They typically used weights to power the movement and a pendulum as the regulator. These clocks were often designed to be highly visible and could be seen from considerable distances, serving as public timekeepers for towns and villages. One notable example was the Old North Church in Boston, better known for the lanterns in the tower that signaled the approach of British troops on April 19, 1775, at the outset of the American Revolution. The tower still has a clock, notably one of the oldest public clocks in Boston, installed in 1726. Yet it seemed odd that 19-year-old Barbara knew anything about clocks on church steeples. There is something else. John had written his story, but confided that he wasn't a writer, and it needed work. He'd sent it to me, but I never read it until after his death. That's when I realized there were differences from what he had told me and what he had written. Had he intentionally embellished some of his writing, maybe to make it sound more interesting, or possibly to make it more supportive of his contention that his and Barbara's experience was more than an accidental walk through a window into the past? He was convinced they had lived a past life together in that village and had been destined to walk back to that life, if only for one evening. Here's an entry from John's journal. Barbara Jean and I awoke in the old graveyard, feeling startled and confused after dozing for what we thought had only been a few minutes. We hugged each other tightly in the darkness, and I could feel her body shaking. Her voice was all choked up, and it sounded as if she was crying. Eventually, her sobs subsided, and she began to sniffle. With a great deal of effort, she was finally able to blurt out, "Oh, John, it was horrible. They both drowned. And whatever became of their children?" I held her and tried to console her, but I wasn't able to muster the strength. In an attempt to comfort her, all I could say was, "I know. I'm so sorry." With that, both of us broke down in each other's arms until the pent-up emotions in our hearts were finally exhausted and spent. We stood up in total silence and then gathered the blanket up from the ground. At that point, we realized both of us, as well as the blanket, were soaking wet. Once it was folded and placed back in her bag, Barbara turned toward me and reached up on the tips of her toes. She planted a petal-soft kiss on my lips and then nestled her head against my chest. Our hearts and souls were feeling an incredible sense of loss, one that neither of us was able to comprehend. We held on to each other tightly and then exchanged another meaningful embrace. We returned to her hotel in muted silence, without ever once looking back toward the village. Our arms were firmly around each other's waists, with each of us totally consumed by our thoughts. When we reached the front door of the hotel, we turned to face each other and shared a comforting hug. We looked deep into each other's eyes, and for a moment it was as if we were looking into each other's souls. After reading that passage, I couldn't help wondering how much of his story was make-believe. He said Barbara was still alive, and he had found her after decades of being out of touch. And she had remembered him, and she remembered the odd village. It wasn't until he contacted her in 2010 that she found out that there was no village, that it had been destroyed 2.5 centuries ago. 10 years later, I would talk to her about her memories.
Chapter 3. More Strangeness. 2 days after his shocking discovery that the village he and Barbara visited didn't exist, He was approved for early liberty and went into town on a research mission. He wanted to see if he could find out anything about the sleepy old hamlet. At that point, he still wasn't certain that it had ever existed. His first stop was at St. George's two-room cultural center, which included memorabilia depicting the parish's long history. He went through all the exhibits and paged through the photo albums and scrapbooks, hoping to find something that would help to explain the mysterious village. He was only able to find a single thing that caught his attention. In one of the photo albums was a picture of a man wearing a nautical hat and standing in front of a few paintings. The caption identified him as Captain Sam, who John figured was the one he wanted to find. The portrait to his right was that of a man and woman he assumed to be members of the old captain's family. John stared at the young woman in the painting and thought she looked very much like Barbara Jean, so much that he felt the two pass for twin sisters. Now he knew that he really needed to find the captain when the Half Moon returned to Bermuda. The apparent time travel experience wasn't the only odd thing that John encountered that week. The day after visiting the cultural center, he and the crew practiced ditch and rescue landing protocols. It was interesting to watch the seaplane pilots trying to follow some of our not-so-well-thought-out landing instructions. The drills kept me occupied and helped to keep me from dwelling on Saint, Catherine, and Barbara Jean. Then, just after dark, we made two nighttime runs, using star shells from our 5-inch 38 main battery for illumination. It was quite a sight. But it was while he was on the 8-12 watch that John saw something inexplicable, another case of something large appearing and disappearing. On the 8-12 watch, he and others began seeing land on the surface search radar. Nothing unusual about that, except they were far out in the Atlantic. The only land within range of their radar was Bermuda, and it was on the other side of the ship. Lights from the island left a glow on the horizon, but they were looking away from Bermuda. Two electronic technicians checked the equipment, but were unable to find anything wrong. The chief electronics tech brought the air search radar online just to see if the landmass showed up on it as well. As soon as the second radar warmed up, they saw the same clearly defined outline as the one on the surface search radar. Up on the bridge, the quartermaster on watch laughingly asked if they had found Atlantis or some other mythical place. After all that had happened to me in the past 6 days, at that point nothing would have surprised me, John recalls. A few minutes before 11 p.m., the mysterious land echoes vanished. On one sweep of the antenna, they were plainly visible, and on the next, they were gone. I couldn't help but wonder why things kept appearing and disappearing here. Interestingly, 1964 was the same year that the name Bermuda Triangle was coined in an article by Vincent Gaddis, entitled The Deadly Bermuda Triangle. The article, published in Argosy magazine, linked a series of unexplained disappearances of ships and planes in the area. Another decade would pass before the name came into common use after the publication of Charles Berlitz's famous book, The Bermuda Triangle. Back in port the next day, John had one more chance to go ashore. He did so, had a couple of drinks at the White Horse Tavern, then walked along the beach toward Fort Saint. Catherine. I closed my eyes and pictured the beautiful, enchanting girl who had been here with me just a few days before. I already missed her and had this terrible fear I might never see her again. After that, I turned back toward St. George and slowly walked back to the ship, feeling very lonely and depressed. A couple of days later, the Half Moon departed from St. George and headed northwest toward New York. He hoped he would be able to sort out his feelings about Barbara Jean and his fiancée before the ship arrived in New York in 3 days. As it turned out, John and his fiancée had a bittersweet reunion. Even though I decided to put my memories of Barbara Jean and Bermuda behind me and concentrate on my long-term relationship with the girl I was engaged to marry, things didn't work out and I broke our engagement several months later. John and Barbara kept in touch over the course of the next several months. John's feelings for her undoubtedly contributed to his decision in February to end his engagement. I tried to express my feelings for Barbara Jean in prose, but found I was unable to write the words that explained how much she had once meant to me. I wrote several poems that seemed to express things infinitely better. she finally asked me not to write her again. Yes, a Dear John letter. And said that she was making one final attempt to salvage her relationship with her overbearing fiancé. Many years later, he would learn that they married 3 years later, adopted a child, and were divorced by 1970.
Chapter 4. Captain Sam, May 1965. John attended oceanography school, and near the end of the course, his class took a training cruise that originated in Portland, Maine, and terminated in St. George, Bermuda. At the end of the trip, he had a full day of liberty ashore before the return trip. He used part of that time to finally visit Captain Sam in St. George. He'd been told that the captain's family had once lived in the village of St. Catherine, and now was John's chance to verify it. Also, he had seen a picture of Sam standing next to a painting of a young couple. The woman in the portrait had an uncanny resemblance to Barbara, and he hoped the captain would be able to explain who she was. The afternoon I spent with him turned out to be extremely informative and helped unravel some of the mysteries about the ethereal village, John told me. After knocking on his door, John introduced himself as a Coast Guardsman on shore leave who wanted to ask Sam about some local history that interested him. Sam was friendly and welcoming once John had mentioned he was with the U.S. Coast Guard and immediately invited him into his home. He told him about the photo he'd seen of him standing by the painting of the couple and how the young woman looked like a girl he knew from the States, whom he had met in Bermuda. Sam led him into an adjacent room where he showed him a 24 by 36 inch portrait, the one that was in the photo. The man was dressed in a naval officer's uniform, and the young woman was wearing what appeared to be a gold-colored gown. He explained that this was his great-great-grandparents' betrothal portrait and had been painted in the 1760s, shortly before they were married. That's when John asked if they had lived in the village of St. Catherine. Captain Sam nodded, studied John for a few moments, then asked him how he knew about the village that was destroyed long ago. He told him that he and the woman he'd met somehow walked into the non-existent village and felt as if they belonged there. He pointed to the woman in the portrait and said she looked exactly how he remembered Barbara Jean. To my surprise, he said he could see a certain resemblance between the naval officer and me. I didn't think the similarity was all that strong, but would have given anything to have had a photo of Barbara Jean to compare with the young woman in the painting. Out of curiosity, I asked him their names. When he answered that they were known as Sir John and Lady Barbara, I had to sit down before I fell over. John looked up at Sam, who stood next to the table, and told him that those names were the same as his own, and his friend who resembled the woman in the portrait. Now Sam looked surprised and confused. He sat down in the chair next to John, then reached into a dusty old cabinet next to the table, and took out an unbound book in which he had recorded information about his family's history, which included photos and newspaper clippings. When he found the pages that he was looking for, he looked up and asked John to explain the details of what had happened during that night in November. He told him all that he remembered, including the strange dream or vision he and Barbara had experienced. As he talked, John started to worry that the captain was thinking he was a lunatic, that his story was too incredible to believe. After John finished, Sam returned his gaze to the book and began to tell him about Sir John and his wife, Lady Barbara. He explained that John, having been a young naval officer, the son of a family from outside of London, and had served during the Seven Years' War. His notes indicated that John had performed several acts of heroism, including one in the Philippine Islands that had left him severely injured. He was knighted in 1764 as Sir John of Grafton by King George III for his bravery, and then posted to Bermuda as the naval attaché to the newly appointed governor. Governor George Brewer would become Sir John's mentor for the next 16 years until they both died, 1 month apart, in 1780. Barbara was the youngest daughter of one of the sons of an English earl. When the earl died, the eldest son assumed the hereditary title and the main estate. The earl's younger sons, including Barbara's father, had inherited the other estates in England and his plantations in the West Indies and Bermuda. As Barbara's father had no sons of his own, he distributed his lands in England and the West Indies to his two oldest daughters. When Barbara was 12 years old, he moved with his wife and daughter to a tobacco plantation in Bermuda. Upon his death, Barbara was supposed to inherit the plantation, but she would not live long enough for that plan to be fulfilled. Sir John and Barbara had first met when he was in his mid-20s, a knighted commoner and war hero, and she was in her late teens and from nobility. After John convinced Barbara's father that he was worthy of her, they were married less than a year later in a church in St. George. They had a daughter and a son, and Barbara was pregnant for the third time when, in 1780, the great hurricane engulfed Bermuda and the couple drowned in the flooding. When the hurricane passed, the couple's two children were found alive on a hillside near the body of their pregnant mother. Seeing that Barbara was in the advanced stages of pregnancy, someone in the rescue party cut open her womb in hopes that her unborn child was still alive. Their effort was successful, and the captain's great-grandmother was born, as he put it, in a most unconventional manner. The two older children were taken back to England by their maternal grandmother. He had no further knowledge of what had become of them. Catherine, as the infant was named, was raised by Barbara's elder sister in the West Indies. She married while still in the West Indies and later gave birth to a son who became the captain's maternal grandfather. Lady Barbara's father never recovered from the loss of his daughter and the departures of his grandchildren to distant places. Days before Lady Josephine was to have returned to Bermuda, she learned of her husband's death. Exercising her dowager rights as his widow, she directed the plantation to be sold and the proceeds put in trust for the benefit of Lady Barbara's three orphan children. Captain Sam told John several more of his family's stories and legends, including a humorous tale about how he had run away to Bermuda to escape a woman in England who desperately wanted him to marry her. He could see that Sam was starting to get tired, and John was feeling overloaded with all the new information. He thanked Captain Sam and went back into town to rejoin his class and return to the States. "A few things started to fall into place as soon as I left him," John wrote in his journal. "The village Barbara and I had walked into on Thanksgiving night matched the old captain's description of the place where his ancestors had lived. The dream or vision the two of us had shared was apparently a view of their all too brief life together and, unfortunately, their horrific deaths. Although I still didn't understand things completely, I was starting to find the existence and destruction of the village much easier to accept. What baffled John the most was how he and Barbara were inexplicably connected to this 18th century British couple. Their our names being the same as the couple's theirs could be dismissed as a coincidence, but the twin-like resemblance between the young woman in the painting and the student nurse from Wisconsin was something he couldn't even begin to explain. The weaker but still discernible resemblance between him and Sir John also baffled him. I would have liked to have shared all this with Barbara Jean, but I knew she was trying to salvage the stormy relationship with her fiancé, and I didn't want to complicate her life any more than it already was. Making things even more difficult was the fact that I was head over heels in love with her. I feared that if I even told her that the village we'd walked into didn't exist, she might think that I was crazy and not want anything to do with me.
Chapter 5. What Happened Later. During the span of the next 7 years, John made 8 or 9 more trips to Bermuda, all in the course of his duties with the Coast Guard. Several times over the years, he retraced the route that he and Barbara had followed. He found the path leading away from the beach, climbed the gentle hill again, wondering if it was possible that this time the ethereal village would take form again and allow him to enter. But he was never able to find any trace of St. Catherine, no sign of the original church or graveyard. A few cows grazed on the grassy field, and he saw the ruins of the more recent unfinished church on the side of a hill, ruins that weren't there when he and Barbara walked up the slope. John was married in 1966 and went on to have 3 children. He described the marriage as ultimately unfulfilling for both spouses, and they separated in the late 1970s. Curiously, on his first date after the separation, he went was to see the Peter Benchley movie, The Deep. It was set in Bermuda, and the scenes brought back memories of Barbara and his early days on the island. "I wished I had known at that time that Barbara Jean was single and unattached," he wistfully wrote Rob in an email. "I would have searched high and low to find her." But reuniting with Barbara was not his fate. His bachelor life ended in 1979 when he met a divorced mother with three daughters, and within 6 months they were married. Whenever he watched a movie or saw a television documentary about Bermuda, his mind would invariably drift back to the night in 1964 when he and Barbara Jean stepped back in time and possibly visited a past life they had shared. With the advent of the internet, John began searching for Barbara, hoping to reconnect. "There were so many things I would have liked to share with her, things about our careers, families, and swapping pictures of our grandchildren." Initially, his efforts were unsuccessful, but he kept trying with the thought that it took 200 years to reconnect with her from that past life. He wouldn't give up. Finally, in August of 2008, 44 years after they had met, it appeared that his months of intense searching might have paid off. He found a listing of a woman named Barbara with her uncommon Polish maiden name listed as her middle name and the surname of her husband. Several additional searches in the town where this Barbara resided showed her middle initial to be J, as in Jean, and her birth date as being in October 1944, as he remembered her telling him. Holding his breath in anticipation, he made two additional searches. The first was for a telephone number, which he found, then made the call and left his name and number and the cryptic message that he believed they had met in Bermuda 44 years ago. He hoped that she would get the message, remember him, and return the call. He clicked a tab for images and submitted her name. After a long delay, a link finally appeared on the screen. I clicked the highlighted reference, and a familiar, beautiful face appeared, one that hardly looked her 63 years of age, let alone someone who might also have been born in the first half of the 18th century. That evening, Barbara returned John's call. She remembered him, and she remembered that magical and mysterious night so many years ago in Bermuda. She remembered the village and how they simultaneously fell asleep outside of the graveyard. She was stunned when John told her that when he went back a couple of days later, there was no village. She listened silently when he explained that he found out that the village of St. Catherine had been destroyed in the great hurricane of 1780. To his relief, she didn't think he was crazy. It was such a wonderful experience to hear her voice after all the intervening years. I felt like I was floating on air, he recalled. Even though both were in committed relationships, he felt they shared a special relationship from another time. After reconnecting with Barbara, John made a random search on his computer for current news from Bermuda. I could hardly believe my eyes when the headline of the main newspaper in Bermuda told of the discovery of the remains of Governor George Bruere, Sir John's mentor, were found under the floorboards of St. Peter's Church in St. George. Yet, records showed that Bruere was buried in the cemetery in the graveyard at St. Peter's. The article mentioned that a research team from Boston was working with the National Trust to determine the circumstances surrounding this somewhat bizarre discovery. For John, the article popping up at that time, just after he had found Barbara after 4 decades and talked to her, was a startling synchronicity, a meaningful coincidence. He was also initially perplexed by how the governor's remains could have ended up under the church's floor. But then, because of his research over the years, he realized he probably knew the answer. The governor died September 10th, 1780, 1 month before the great hurricane of October 10th, 1780, and the storm had caused severe flooding in Bermuda and hundreds of deaths, including the deaths of Sir John and Barbara. He deduced that the recently buried coffin had floated free of the grave and was rescued by the local inhabitants. Since the governor had been a high official, it was likely that the coffin would have been stashed somewhere safe until it could be reinterred in the graveyard. Considering the numerous deaths and the extent of disorder and confusion following the devastating hurricane, the matter of reburial had probably been put aside and forgotten.
In the aftermath of reconnecting with Barbara, John renewed his interest in the mysterious incident from 4 decades ago. With the help of his sister Ellen, John spent an evening poring over high-resolution imagery of the parish of St. George taken from space. Using Google Earth, they retraced the steps he and Barbara had taken on that night long ago. Once they found the old road with the hill that overlooked St. Catherine, the rest of their search was relatively easy. Traces of the foundations from the old village plainly stood out once they knew where to look. Seeing its location so close to the ocean, it was easy to understand that the hamlet never had a chance when the monstrous waves of the great hurricane crashed ashore. Most of the buildings had been constructed on land a mere just 6 feet above sea level, no match for the 14-foot-high wall of water that surged over the village. John and Barbara stayed in touch, and as they talked about their lives, they discovered some amazing facts that could relate to the idea that they had lives as Sir John and Barbara in the 18th century. Barbara had avoided ever getting pregnant after experiencing repeated disturbing visions of being subjected to a C-section without anesthesia. She also avoided going in the water at all costs, having a morbid fear she might drown. This was so severe it caused her to resign her commission in the Navy Nurse Corps. John, for his part, had horrific nightmares about being treated with bloodlettings, a common and highly unpleasant treatment for wounds in the 18th century. When his doctor informed him in 2007 that he needed to undergo bloodlettings as the main treatment for polycythemia, a blood-thickening disorder, he was so upset by the procedure that he had to take tranquilizers before the treatment. In addition, both John and Barbara had inexplicable feelings of familiarity when they first visited England. I was confident John didn't make up this incredible story, but I definitely wanted to talk to Barbara myself. We exchanged several emails in which she clearly remembered walking into that village with John. But her memories were not as detailed as John's. She did not remember anything about the clock on the church steeple. Yet she remembered sitting on the wall by the cemetery, then lying down on the blanket in front of the wall. She remembered falling asleep, but not anything about a past life. While she remembered feeling attracted to the village, she didn't think in terms of it being a past life residence. 52 years ago, I was 19 years old and had no awareness of past lives. When I met John, he was respectful, comforting, and safe to be with, so it felt okay to go off alone with him and away from the group. It felt like I had known him before. When we arrived at the village, I remember that it felt familiar and inviting, but I have no recollection or sense of having lived there. It may have been different more than half a century ago, but now I have no recollection. What I remember about the village was the church, and very vividly a stone wall where we sat as we talked and rested. It was indeed a memorable 24 hours. Barbara has never returned to Bermuda and was unaware that the village was destroyed in 1780 until John told her. When John contacted me 8 years ago and shared his findings, I could relate fully to this since I have been interested in past, present, and future lives through most of my adult life, which was contrary to my family upbringing as a Christian. Recently, I have been studying the Buddhist perspective on past lives. It confirms my beliefs. The fact that there are many others who have also had experiences of past lives is also very affirming. Direct experience has a lot to say about realities. Upon reflection, Barbara says that some of the events of her life now seem more understandable, considering what John learned about the woman she might have been in the 18th century. I've had many dreams throughout my life about being married in a small church. I never was married in a small church in this lifetime. I also have been unexplainably fearful and sometime in panic when swimming in deep water. I have always been a good swimmer in this life and would swim laps daily in 3 feet of water. If I would go to the deep end of a pool or lake, I would start feeling very anxious. Yet I have always been drawn to the ocean and the waves and have found the rolling waves particularly calming. However, I would never get onto a cruise ship, even if it offered the world to me. I like having the earth under my feet. So when John said I drowned during a hurricane in Bermuda, it resonated with my attraction as well as my panic. John and Barbara stayed in touch from 2008 until his death in 2019. But they never met face to face again since Thanksgiving Day, 1964. If indeed the two had lived in the 18th century as another John and Barbara and walked into their village, what possible mechanism allowed that to happen? Did the hurricane have anything to do with it? And if so, was their experience related to the Bermuda Triangle phenomenon? Those questions probably will never be answered, and John and Barbara's encounter with the past and their past lives will remain a mystery within a greater mystery.
Thanks for joining the Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening and stay mystical.